I'm Jackie Lydon. Michelle Martin is away. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the staff, with your help, chose some of the most fascinating people of 2007. Today you'll hear the story of an upstart college football team out of Hawaii. They're on their way to the Sugar Bowl, and indeed, the feeling is sweet. But first, the numbers are frightening. Millions and millions of people are stranded in substandard housing. Joining us to talk about this is Javier de Souza Briggs. He's an associate professor of sociology and urban planning at MIT, and Professor Lawrence J. Vail also joins us. He's head of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at MIT. Gentlemen, thanks both of you for being here.
Good to be with you.
Good to be with you.
I think you heard a wee bit of our conversation with our activists from New Orleans, and obviously things there have been extremely rancorous and provocative, the contention being that housing for the poor is being reduced and that mixed-income housing isn't a sufficient replacement. Maybe we could just open with that as a theoretical and see what you both make of that.
Well, the first thing to say is that mixed-income housing isn't in itself a problem. The problem is that it tends to be mixing out the poor people from a public housing stock without mixing in poor people into enough of the other housing stock in order to make more of it affordable.
This is Professor Briggs, right?
No, that's Larry Vail.
Thank you very much. You both may just tell me who you are for a moment or two. That'd be great.
And this is Professor Briggs. To add to what Larry was saying, you know, we've been losing affordable housing stock for the better part of a generation, and this is what underlies the crisis you pointed to, Jackie, with those multi-million numbers. And mixed-income housing accelerated in the 90s, mainly as a public housing replacement policy, and it has a lot to speak for it, but New Orleans is an extreme case of what we've seen play out around the country, where the fear is, in some cases the reality too, that you'd be displacing people, rebuilding mainly for market-rate tenants and to please them, and removing some of the things that made public housing give it a reputation for blight, but without necessarily meeting the housing needs of the worst off. I think, as Larry says, it doesn't have to be that way, but you need to install safeguards.
Well, why do you think things in New Orleans have become as polarized as they have been? There's obviously a lot of fear and anger. It's drawing housing activists from around the country. This is obviously a scenario that is not desirable, but the fear must be real.
Well, you know, the media reported in the short weeks, or in the early weeks, I should say, after Katrina, that there was talk of Katrina having done what decades of public policy couldn't, in other words, wipe out public housing and displace the ghetto poor and so on. And I think that perception stuck, that what we had was the beginning of a land grab that could lead to substantial redevelopment, in some cases public housing in New Orleans, as in other cities, is very, very well located. It's on prime land. And there was this perception that there was a tremendous amount of development interest, private investor and developer interest in being able to redevelop now that this had sort of been cleared out in a way that wouldn't have been politically possible before, a real redevelopment of the city along the lines that the activists in your prior segment described. And I'm simply saying that's why the perception, I think, was so strong and so immediate.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly something that would have been there as a perception and a level of mistrust long before Katrina struck. The track record of public housing in New Orleans before the flooding and before this latest catastrophe was not good, and the level of support for low-income people was not good. And you have these kinds of protests going around in many cities that have thought about replacing large segments of their public housing stock. But in particular, when you have a situation where there is as little trust and as little sense that the situation is going to get better for the least advantaged, it can only get worse.
Go ahead.
What seems to be happening is a sense of the larger picture of affordable housing crisis is coming in direct competition with the people who need housing the most at the lowest income, and so competing for affordability in housing are the upwardly mobile working poor, the people that are seen and described as workforce housing, and the people who have been in public housing as a kind of last resort before homelessness or a first step back from homelessness, who also feel that in many cases they're part of the workforce and are being squeezed out deliberately.
I'm struck by something was just said about the need for some kind of political trust and leadership. I started my career in Chicago, where obviously large downtown public housing projects were a part of the political landscape and were torn down. Professor Briggs, you worked on that transformation. What were some of the lessons from that?
Well, I think on one hand, there was in Chicago, as there is to a different degree in New Orleans, perceptions aside for the moment, there was something of a window of opportunity to dramatically transform public housing in a city that had, you know, built more of it concentrated in particular blocks, in particular areas of the city that became racial ghettos, than anywhere else on earth. And Mayor Daley recognized that opportunity thanks to changes in federal policy, and the city worked out with HUD, with the federal government, an agreement for transforming public housing, bringing down all of the high-rises, all those infamous ones that were in the headlines, especially
Robert Taylor Homes, Henry Horner Homes, Cabrini Green.
Exactly. And it was bumpy. I mean, it was a difficult transformation. Mistakes were made. There were families that fell between the cracks. They didn't get adequate counseling to rent up in private apartments using rental housing vouchers from the federal government. The redevelopment, however, has picked up steam. There have been successes. I think it's misleading to say mixed-income development doesn't work or there aren't examples of it. I think there are some very good examples, but it, you know, depends in part on how you define success as well. But Chicago has made tremendous progress, but it has come at a real cost to the most vulnerable families.
The easier part seems to be the demolition. It's easier to eliminate public housing, but to do so is not to solve the problem of housing the lowest income segments of the public. So really, the package that has to happen in New Orleans and elsewhere is a larger vision for how what the government's role can be as a partner in housing a diverse population, diversity by income. And all of that should be seen by all people in cities as necessary to support the kind of growth in the economy that everyone would like to see happen.
Does there need to be an interim step? Is New Orleans missing an opportunity here to assure people that they'll have this other housing ready by not providing more affordable units right now?
Well, I think on one hand, you know, you think of FEMA trailers, right, as temporary housing, and it has a mostly poor reputation. Transitional housing doesn't have a great history except for the well-designed stuff that houses the formerly homeless and whatnot. But New Orleans ought to commit to replacing the affordable housing supply, reduced through any redevelopment of public housing, even if the units aren't rebuilt on site. In other words, if you do an income mix, and there would be some compelling reasons to do that, I think it does need to assure families, and this is certainly a mistake that we made in Chicago and we've made in other cities, is assuming that if the private apartments are out there somewhere, these families will be able to rent them. And we've learned the hard way that's not the case. Landlords don't have to accept the federal subsidy. There is discrimination, pervasive discrimination in the market, not only by race, but against families with children and on other bases as well. So I think that interim assurance, Jackie, would be very important.
All right. Well, listen, I want to thank both of you for being with us. We've been talking with Javier de Souza Briggs, an associate professor of planning at MIT, and Professor Lawrence Vail, head of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at MIT. Thanks, both of you, very, very much.
Thanks very much, Jack.
Thank you.